If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
We tend to harvest at least 2 weeks in advance compared to like 20 years ago, for example.
To farm 128 acres of wine grapes here, we need about 30 people. It's a labor-intensive industry.
No doubt about it. The easy part in the wine business is actually making the wines, however selling it and branding it. That's a completely different story.
We've done more single vineyard calves, and it's really been the vineyard telling us where to go more than us saying, oh, we want to do single vineyard calves.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 422. This week we feature Kelby James Russell of Red Newt Cellars, Finger Lakes, New York. We continue our adventures into the wineries of the Finger Lakes region of New York with winemaker Kelby James Russell of Red Newt Cellars. As our listeners know, winemakers come from many different backgrounds, but Kelby's background is certainly unusual. As part of his journey, he studied orchestral management. These are some of the flavors that create great winemakers. Art, science, music, nature, to name a few. Keep this in mind while you listen in to learn more about the Finger Lakes region. You can also hear Kelby on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term donut. Well, I'm on the phone this time around with Kelby Russell. Kelby is the winemaker at Red Newt Cellars in the Finger Lakes region of New York. How are you doing, Kelby?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm doing good. Thanks for doing this Monday morning, kind of not quite first thing, but early enough. Mondays can be a challenge, but right now you should probably be in a reasonable workflow, I would think, for this time of year, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're very much in the sort of lazy winter period. I think it's a lazy because the vines and the wines are both sleeping, and I think it's lazy because on the winemaking side, we're still recovering from harvest and the holidays.
Yeah, it's rough to do that. When do you guys normally prune versus other climates in the country, West Coast, for example, much colder for this time of year for you?
Yeah, you'll see some people going out and pruning this time of year, but the rule of thumb for most, especially with the vinifera, so the European grapes that most of us work the hardest on, usually more in the March time frame. We push it a little bit later than other regions might, just because we don't want to go out and prune too much in January and then have a February cold snap that puts some of the buds at risk. So kind of get a feel for what the winter damage might look like in January and February, and then actually do the real work in March.
It's funny when you say the winter damage. I mean, is that something typical for you to face every year?
Yeah, I think kind of rule of thumb in a normal winter is that something like 15% of the buds might not make it through. I'm a little out over my skis here. I don't know. I feel like there's some amount of damage that you would expect in any region just from the process of the vine shutting down and then booting back up. But certainly the cold temperatures in the Finger Lakes make it a little bit more fraught.
Sure. Well, this is January 25th, if I'm not mistaken. Just want to set a frame for listeners. What's your temperature there today?
Today is actually probably the coldest day we've had this winter so far, which has been quite mild. And we woke up, it was about 10 degrees out, and then the sun's actually coming down pretty nice here, so we're up into the low mid-30s already.
Yeah, it's been a strange winter, certainly for the part of the country I'm in, which is the Midwest. We have not had what I would call typical winters.
No, yeah, it's the same here. We're used to quite a bit of snow by this time of year. It hasn't been, I don't know, and out your way, it hasn't been particularly warm here, but it hasn't been cold. And I think that's the thing we've noticed. Like the high temperatures are in the low 30s, which is correct. But, you know, 10 is probably the lowest temperature we've seen so far this winter, which is crazy.
Yeah, I would agree. It has not been cold. Milwaukee, which is where I'm at, is definitely tends to get much colder today. I think it was 18 when I rambled out of bed. But all that aside, the challenge is, of course, making wine when you've got cooler weather. So, which leads me to the, of course, climate change issues. I assume that's had an effect on you.
Yeah, it absolutely has. It's one of those dual effects. I mean, I'm sure there's many ways of dissecting it. But for us, on one hand, things are getting warmer. We are consistently having warmer and warmer growing seasons. Grapes that may have seemed crazy to put in the ground 20 years ago, now you can pretty regularly ripen, which is fascinating and is certainly an exciting thing in the Finger Lakes. But what worries us most and worries us much more is the, it's not just about warming, right? It's the swings and the extremes that we're seeing because of climate change. And, none of us can forget the polar vortex back-to-back winters in 2014, 15, kind of going into 16, that just did tons of damage to a lot of different crops, but certainly to grapes here, because it was just these cold snaps that came out of nowhere and are like nothing that I remember growing up.
Sure. The unpredictability of being in that part of the country has become even more unpredictable.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about you. Let's talk about your journey to wine. First of all, how long have you been the winemaker at Red Newt?
I've been the winemaker here since really early 2013. I came to Red Newt in 2012 as the assistant winemaker, and then after about a half year here and getting through the harvest, Dave Whiting, who's the founding owner and founding winemaker, took a step back and was happy to let me kind of fumble and take over for the ever since.
Nice. So your particular journey in wine, we always ask people about that aha moment. Were you maybe raised in a wine-drinking, wine-loving family? I mean, what has your journey been?
I was raised in a family that loved food and wine and loved just mealtime. I think looking back on my childhood, I grew up in between Rochester and Syracuse on an Erie Canal town. So in the Finger Lakes, but kind of not in the heart of the Finger Lakes by any means. And wine wasn't anything that a premium was put on. It was just something I remember my parents having a glass of with any dinner. Nothing fancy. It was just kind of a way of life sort of thing. The funny part is they would always offer it to me, and I would always refuse because I was just scandalized at the idea of drinking if I was under 21. So, the joke really swung around at the end of my journey here. I grew up that way, and I went to college and majored technically in government and economics, but my career path was towards orchestra management, so I had no real intersection with wine.
Well, of course. All that makes for a perfect winemaker.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, all the skills you could possibly need.
Yes.
Although I feel like managing musicians is probably very similar to managing grape ferments. So.
Or herding cats.
Yes, yeah, you have no control, and so long as you accept that, you're actually in good shape.
There you go. I'm a musician, so I can totally relate to that. So,
yeah.
How did you find this door that you clearly went through with both feet?
Yeah, I mean, I loved food when I was growing up and loved cooking and got fascinated by, this was kind of the early rise of Food Network, and they had a lot of stars that were pretty, clever is not the right word. They were smart. They were really intelligent speakers to food and took it seriously. I'm thinking of someone like Alton Brown, who kind of brought a science side to food in particular. And I was a pretty sharp student. I ended up going to Harvard for undergrad. And I think that synthesis of you could pursue food but also do it in a really intelligent way appealed to me. So that was always kind of percolating in the back of my brain. I really fell in love with Italian food and Italian food culture, especially through the Bill Buford book, Heat. That was kind of like an aha moment for me and led me to apply for a fellowship to travel to Italy in between my junior and senior years at college. And it was a fellowship that, you apply and you have this great experience, and it's basically just a lump sum of cash, and you get to go and use it as you see fit. But you had to explain what you were going to do and why, and I think they were just baffled that amongst all of the offerings from people who wanted to go for more noble pursuits, whether that's, art or architecture or history or any of these things you would expect, I was just bold-faced enough to say, no, I want to go for food and wine and understand Italian culture through food and wine. And they awarded me the fellowship. And, Italy's not the cheapest place to go visit. It wasn't a huge stipend, and I decided to spread my funds out by exchanging my work on a winery for room and board. So I was in southern Tuscany working on a vineyard on a castle, like an old medieval castle estate. Incredibly romantic in pictures, if the work was quite hard, but I also loved the work.
Yeah, interesting. You don't meet really too many lazy winemakers, I'll say that for sure.
No.
How long were you over there?
I was over there for about 4 weeks total. I was 3 weeks on the estate. And I came back and kind of got back into my senior year of college and was pursuing, you know, seminars through the American Symphony Orchestra League and really chasing down that career path. And I just kept having this like nagging thought in the back of my head about how much I'd enjoyed the lifestyle and the sort of creative pursuit and the hard work of the being on the vineyard. The more I learned about orchestra management, at least at that stage, it's as important and as critical as that work is. What had attracted me to it was that I was a singer, and I loved that artistic process. And the more I learned about orchestra management, the more I realized that you're kind of alienated from the art making itself. And in a way, winemaking seemed like a better synthesis of what I was good at and what I was looking to do.
Interesting. Leaving Italy must have been hard with that experience under your belt, especially because the work was hard.
Yes. Yeah, it was. It just kind of kept, you know, it's still the photo that I took from the vineyards of that castle is still the background photo on my iPhone, of all things. So it was hard to leave, but it inspired me to start taking not like formal W set sort of classes, just like little wine tasting events that were happening around campus or some whatever opportunities I could see to kind of glob onto to learn a little bit more about wine in a more theoretical sense.
Sure. So how did you come to Red Newt?
I graduated in 2009 into the great job market that was. And rather than trying to chase down an orchestra job, I actually did have a good run or a potential job with Jazz at Lincoln Center that I was going after.
Wow.
And which would have been right up my alley as someone who has always loved jazz and performed jazz. But in the end, they went with an internal candidate, and they did that basically the same day that I threw up my hands and showed up on the doorstep of Fox Run, which is a winery here in the Finger Lakes of some renown, for sure.
Sure, yeah.
And Peter Bell, the winemaker there, saw me show up and say I was interested. And now that I've been through this myself, I realize why he was a little hesitant, shall we say. We have a lot of people who say they're interested in working at a winery and don't actually understand what that means. And certainly I fit that bill. I showed up in like a dress shirt and like nice slacks for an interview on the first day of harvest in 2009. So that tells you how out of water I was in that that scenario. And he handed me a shovel and I shoveled grape skins the rest of the day. And then I think to his surprise, I showed up the next day again, much more appropriately attired for the work. And I just kept showing up day after day. And this was still a time when you could kind of intern for free. That doesn't really exist anymore. You know, there's good reasons for that. You don't want that system to be abused. But that's really the way I cut my teeth, was working a harvest more or less in exchange for the experience without any real benefits or pay outside of that. You know, it's a great industry to figure out whether you like it or not. You work harvest for 6 weeks, and you either are in or you're not. It's very cut and dried.
Yeah, it's very black and white. You don't want to go back to that if you don't want to go back to that, period.
Yes. Yeah, so I worked the harvest at Fox Run in 2009, and then Peter thought that it would work well for me to try a harvest down in the Southern Hemisphere. That was pretty uncommon at that point for getting into the wine industry in the Finger Lakes. There wasn't a lot of this traveling winemaker back and forth that we're pretty used to now, and certainly that the West Coast was used to at that time. But he put me in touch with a winery in Marlborough down in New Zealand, and I went down that, I guess, Northern Hemisphere spring, Southern Hemisphere fall, had a great time working my second harvest, came back and worked at Fox Run again, went down to Tasmania the next time around, back to Fox Run again, and then one final time to the Southern Hemisphere in 2012. I was the night shift red winemaker for Yalumba at their premium site in the Barossa Valley.
Wow.
And basically went straight from that. I'd already been hired by Red Newt before I even went down there. You know, it just kind of worked out timing-wise to do that job and then come back to the Finger Lakes and start right up at Red Newt. And Red Newt and Fox Run have always been close compatriots. You know, the joke at the time was that I'd been traded to Red Newt for draft picks to be named later. but it was a great fit right from the start and gave me a chance to have You know, after 3 years of bouncing back and forth between hemispheres, it's nice to have a full-time job without having to uproot your life and move every 6 months.
So. Sure. But what a great experience to be able to be doing wine in a completely different place. I mean, that's just fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the lessons are just amazing. You know, you learn a lot about sort of winemaking philosophy that way. I think people get too hung up on wanting to do a traveling harvest that has the exact same grapes that they work with that they're in their home region. It's kind of a different lens on the same grape. And really, you can pick up a lot just from working with grapes you'll never see again in your life, you know, if you're paying attention.
Well, just like anything else, the more experience in the area, just well-versed you become.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm going to step aside from this for one moment. I have to ask the obligatory question about Red Newt. Where did the name come from?
So Red Newt was named by Dave and Deb Whiting when they founded the winery in 98. And they're these little newts that run all around the Finger Lakes, actually. They love freshwater creeks and streams, and they're red during the adolescent phase of their life. But we see them pretty regularly. They like the creeks around here. There's no shortage of water in the Finger Lakes, no shortage of creeks. And during harvest, it's pretty typical that at least one day during harvest, one of them will kind of skitter across the cellar floor, because the cellar floor is about as, you know, it might as well be a creek during harvest with how much water is being used.
Sure. Interesting. Good name. You know, Finger Lakes are just a wonderful place for people to discover. But do you have other areas in the country, and certainly obvious places like, you know, Napa, Sonoma, Willamette Valley, but other areas that you find making some pretty amazing wine at this particular point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the region that we are most interested in as of late has been Walla Walla. I think there's some great things coming out from Washington State that aren't the sort of the big brands that we all know, but a lot of really interesting boutique wineries out there that I feel like are somewhat overlooked right now. You know, I think California is always doing relatively well. I think Oregon did a good job building a brand for themselves as being a bit more boutique-y, but I feel like the smaller producers in Eastern Washington are doing some incredible things with really cool grapes, and they just haven't quite broke through yet.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a good observation. So overall, is there something in any way that turns you off about wine as a winemaker?
I think the obvious answer is the real one, which is the potential for it to be abused. You know, I think that's always a complicated factor. I think especially in the U.S. where we don't necessarily have a sort of the cultural appreciation of alcohol as part of a meal in a very measured way. I kind of keep in mind that the wines I'm making are not the sort of wines that people are slamming to get drunk for cheap. But there's always this like thin line that you're walking when you're making an alcoholic beverage. You know, someone like me trying to make it incredibly thoughtfully, and because it can transport you, but you know, you want that to be done responsibly.
Yeah, I agree. It's a tough thing. And speaking of the wines, tell me about the wines you're making. Obviously, Riesling's very big there.
Yes, absolutely. And Red Newt, one of the reasons I was so excited to work at Red Newt is because it had already fashioned itself as a Riesling house before I arrived. You know, it sounds like you would think that would be obvious, that you would be a winery in the Finger Lakes and Riesling would be your forte. But even when I started in the industry back in 2009, it was commonplace for people to ask what the signature grape of the Finger Lakes was going to be, even though from a winemaking perspective, that had been solved long ago. So Red Newt was a little bit ahead of the curve in that regard, both in terms of just sheer percentage of production that's Riesling, it's about three quarters here, but also in terms of the bottlings that they did, both before I got there and ever since, which is, you know, a few kind of classic core style bottlings of Riesling, but then a bunch of different single vineyard bottlings to really celebrate different sites and different soils around the Finger Lakes. So kind of as a young winemaker in 2012, Red Newt was, you know, kind of exactly hit what I thought the wine industry was looking for.
What other grapes are you working with at this point?
Yeah, the second main one for us, and I think kind of the leading red grape in the Finger Lakes, is Cab Franc. It's not a pairing you see elsewhere in the wine world, but for whatever reason, those two grapes really work well in the Finger Lakes. I think, you know, you can tell they work well because they're both terroir expressive. They've kind of speak to their, you know, different sites have wildly different versions of the same grape from the same year in a way that can be predicted, which is fun as a winemaker. It's nice to have that flexibility. So Cab Franc is our other big grape, a few different styles of that, from kind of fresh and stainless steel to, you know, more of a reserve style that would be oaked and barreled down. And then everyone does a smattering of different things. Red Newt has a bit of a name for itself with Gewürztraminer. We've always loved Gewürztraminer. It's obviously a grape that inspires very strong opinions, both in terms of whether people like it at all, and if they do like it, what style they like. So it's never going to be a gangbuster of a seller, but it's something that we have a lot of fun making.
Sure. Anything different, strange, out of the ordinary for the area?
We do a little bit of Grüner Veltliner, which you don't see a lot of in the Finger Lakes, even though it's something that, with the right handling, works really nicely. And then I think the biggest thing that we do that's a little out of the ordinary, we have a pretty robust fortified program, in particular sherry styles. So both those that are aged under floor yeast, and the sort of the classic sort of dry sherry fino and manzanilla expression, but also styles that are fortified and then aged in larger casks for years and years and years to slowly oxidize and kind of become these beautiful liquids.
Very nice. Do you, as a winemaker, do you take the opportunity? Do you like to spend time in the tasting room from time to time, or is that something you avoid?
No, I like spending time in the tasting room. I think I tend to enjoy even more going out into the market, not that that's really possible right now.
Yeah.
But I love getting out and talking about the wines. I think especially coming from the Finger Lakes, there's so much excitement and so much that can be taught about them. Even when I'm dealing with beverage professionals, you know, there's so much ground to teach and to make up for. It's really exciting to get out. And even in New York City, you would think New York City is saturated with Finger Lakes wine knowledge, and that's just not the case, let alone when we get a little further afield.
Yeah, sure. But how do you handle people when you come into objections? I don't like that. I don't drink whites, or I won't touch reds, or I only drink wines from so-and-so. I mean, how do you combat something like that?
I think anytime you encounter that, you always want to start from a place of, trying to find the common ground. I don't think anyone's really predisposed to disliking something. It's more so often in the wine world, it's because they've either been told they should dislike it, or they've been made to feel that disliking it is the correct response.
Yeah.
I mean, we see this with Riesling all the time. People think Riesling's sweet, which, you know, it by no means has to be and oftentimes isn't. And then someone who has learned that and likes dry Riesling, they'll almost go too far in the opposite direction. And if you present them with a beautifully made, a reserve-style off-dry Riesling or you know, like a German-style Cabernet or Spätlese style with lower alcohol, higher RS, you almost get this kickback reaction of like, oh, well, I don't like it because it's sweet, and that makes me a better wine drinker because I know that it's sweet.
Yeah.
And it's just the patience to kind of point out, like, the amount of care that goes into making those wines. It's not, I think people think of sweetness in particular as like a Band-Aid or a cover-up, which it can be, but not when you're talking about, you know, any small, thoughtful producer. If there's sweetness there, it's because they think that's the right expression of the wine. And mind you, the same people, you know, that this is not to pick on anyone, but the same people who will tell you that they don't like Riesling because it's sweet will be drinking a Coca-Cola, right, which is like sweeter than an ice wine. And you're like, okay, well.
That's funny. I like that. I've never heard anybody say that before, but it's a good point. So when you're talking to people in this scenario, how do you describe smells to people? How do you get them there without being too suggestive to say, well, you should smell this?
Yeah, I think it's exactly what you just said, is not trying to prescribe what they're smelling. I'm always willing to give my aroma descriptors that I'm getting from a glass, but I keep them pretty general. And I like to tell people when I have a chance to talk about it, if I'm kind of leading a tasting, that I almost think about my own wine tasting journey as kind of like the path of most, artistic movements. Right, like I started out and I couldn't describe anything that I was smelling, but I was trying and it was kind of clunky as I put words to what I thought I smelled. And then I started to get better with practice, like anyone would. And then you kind of enter this, like, you go from this classical phase where you're really describing things succinctly and well to going into the Baroque phase. And, you know, I'd have these, like, incredible long tasting notes about a wine with, like, all these incredibly specific tasting notes and flavors I was getting and structural comments and, you know, on and on and on, like, sentences, the sort of thing that people expect to see in a wine magazine. And then, like so many things, I've kind of returned back to home. Like, now half the time in my own wine notebook, if I'm marking something down about a wine, it's usually like, oh, this, you know, I love the structure on this. It tastes great. And that will be my whole note. So it's almost like I've come right back around to the beginning of my journey.
I think that's a logical evolution, though, isn't it? Because you get past all the what you should be's kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah, you know, whatever it tastes like is what it tastes like. And the thing that has always remained true, no matter where you are in your wine tasting journey, is that you know whether you like something or not. And that's really all that matters.
Right.
And it's nice to kind of go through the exercise to get better at putting your finger down on why you like something. But at some point, you don't need to, I don't know, come up with more convoluted reasons for that.
Sure. Well said. That's good. I'm sure you've had some crazy experiences in the vineyard or in the cellar. I mean, can you think of what's one of the weirdest things you've seen or crazy things as a winemaker?
The one that jumps to mind, because I'm sure there's a bunch every year, but the one that jumps to mind, we had an intern once who took a 2-inch valve off the bottom of a full 3,000-gallon tank of very actively fermenting wine.
Oh, my.
It was kind of like peak ferment. And it was, I mean, I'm someone who deals with these situations calmly and also in a with a laugh, because it just is what it is. There's no reason to get upset about it.
Sure.
The intern was actually really good, really talented. And you just sometimes you just make a silly mistake. You know, he thought it was a tank he was supposed to clean next. So he's like, oh, it's got a valve on the bottom. Take the valve off to clean it. And boy, he was wrong. So he threw himself in front of it and blocked the exit port with his hand. And then I ran over with Megs, the assistant winemaker here. And like the three of us carefully talked through a plan of how we were going to attempt to get a valve back on it. He removed his hand and we like shoved the valve on with a gasket and closed it off and clamped it down with just, you know, getting absolutely like Niagara Falls soaked from the amount of pressure trying to rock it out from behind it. But, you know, in the end, I think we lost 30 gallons, which is...
Oh, wow. That's not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all for the situation. I think we all lost that set of clothes because, I mean, there's not much to do when something that it's like soaking your clothes in sourdough starter or something. It was just like there was no saving them after that.
That's a good story. It's funny. I appreciated when you said this intern was talented because we all do dumb things.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. And, you know, harvest in particular is just a stressful time. Everyone's going to make some mistakes. And, you know, to me, it's how you respond to the mistake that tells me a lot more about you. You know, it's one, don't put the blame off somewhere else. And two, like, you know, if you dealt with it and you dealt with it with as much of a smile as you could, then you're doing great.
Well, I like that you said remaining calm, just like any emergency, any level of it. Remaining calm is the key. Panicking, you're going to lose it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's like the number one through line of the best winemakers is just that kind of, it's probably true of chefs as well to some extent.
Sure.
If you think about, you know, when you're in the weeds with orders coming in, it's like the people who are able to just kind of like methodically work through what needs to get worked through end up on the aggregate doing best.
Sure. And inherently working in the cellar can be dangerous. It's, I don't want to say it's like factory work, but there are certainly ways you can hurt yourself badly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the health and safety side of working in a cellar is something that I think we're sometimes a little too lax about in the U.S. Maybe I can't really speak to California, and California is probably further ahead on this, but certainly compared to any of my time in Australia or New Zealand, where you would, like, show up at a winery and you would have to go through 3 or 4 days of safety training.
Wow.
To you know, just to be able to work in the cellar. And a lot of it felt kind of silly, like confined space entry, like how to test for carbon monoxide. And the trainer would be like, you have to be ready for carbon monoxide. And everyone would be like, we don't worry. Like, we need to be able to detect CO2, but CO is not really the concern in the wine world. And like, well, what if a forklift pulls up in front of the tank that you're in and just idles there for 30 minutes? And it's like, well, that is a thing that could happen, but we're kind of out on the tail end of the distribution of likely outcomes here. Like, much more common is just CO2 knocking you over.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Kelby, for the time you've been in the business, I'm sure you've done plenty of press. What is the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Ooh, this is a great question. Let me put my thinking cap on here. You know, I feel like, and it's a fun question because it makes me think of the answer as well, but is what, knowing what I now know, what other industry I could have seen myself in.
Hmm.
I think it's so common to talk about, you know, right, so much of my time talking about my journey into wine, people kind of come up with this version of me that is me as an orchestra manager or me as a winemaker. And in reality, like, once I got into wine, there's not this counterfactual of me or parallel universe of me as a orchestra manager just isn't real. But the more time I spend in wine, the more that I feel like my alter ego would be a meteorologist, because I'm just so fascinated by the weather. And that's, you know, it's something that I always was interested in growing up. But when you're in the wine industry, you almost end up with a minor in meteorology just by dint of the circumstances of harvest. And I just find myself going down ridiculous, like, technical Twitter rabbit holes about, like, cold fronts and things like this that I have no business spending time reading about, but I just find myself fascinated by it now.
But it's not unusual. I've seen plenty of wineries that have actually had little mini weather links or whatever on their websites, because it is so integral to what you're doing.
Yeah. It's the beautiful kind of reality of winemaking, where it's something that you want to understand, but it's something you know that you don't have control over. And that, to me, is kind of winemaking in a nutshell.
It is. It is. No control for being basically a control freak somewhat, kind of partially, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Kelby, for our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you online and about the winery, what is your website?
Yeah, the website is rednewt.com. Super simple there. And then if anyone looks me up, like so much of the wine world, on Instagram, I'm just Kelby James Russell on Instagram. And I'm constantly posting about our various exploits in the cellar or vineyard.
Kelby, this is great. It's been so much fun learning about the Finger Lakes. We've only gotten into it last year. And I got to say, you guys are fantastic to talk to. You've done a great job. I look forward to trying your wine sometime. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your Monday.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for giving the Finger Lakes some time.
Learn more by visiting rednewt.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.